Road to Cinema's final draft screenwriting software giveaway continues. All you have to do is follow us on Twitter, at Jog Road, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Jog Road, or subscribe to our YouTube channel, Jog Road Productions. All three ways enter you into the contest. We'll be announcing our first winner at the end of March, so stay tuned and see if you can win a free voucher to purchase Final Draft screenwriting software, brought to you by our friends at Final Draft. Welcome to episode number 28 of the Road to Cinema podcast, featuring author Josh Karp as we discuss his new book entitled Orson Welles' Last Movie, The Making of The Other Side of the Wind. The Other Side of the Wind is Orson Welles' yet-to-be-completed final film, which has been languishing in post-production for the last three decades due to a series of complicated legal and financial conflicts, which are chronicled in Karp's new book. The drama and chaos of The Other Side of the Wind also goes into the production process, which went on for almost 5 years. The film stars John Huston as a down-on-his-luck director who returns to Hollywood with the hopes of making a comeback movie, but that movie just may be his personal and professional ruin. The film also stars Peter Bogdanovich as Brooks Oderlake, an up-and-coming filmmaker and former journalist. Since Orson's death in 1985, many people have tried to complete The Other Side of the Wind, but unfortunately the film's negative has been locked away in a vault in Paris, France. We'll discuss in the interview how people close to Welles, including Peter Bogdanovich, Frank Marshall, and the late Gary Graver, have been instrumental in trying to complete The Other Side of the Wind, along with current advocate Philippe Jane Rimshaw, who just may have completed an agreement with the Welles estate to finally finish the film, according to a New York Times article published last October. For more information on the Road to Cinema podcast, to read the Road to Cinema blog, and to watch our Road to Cinema YouTube series, please visit jogroadproductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter, at Jog Road, for the latest updates. And now we join author Josh Karp as he discusses his inspiration behind writing his new book, Orson Welles' Last Movie, The Making of The Other Side of the Wind.
I had written two prior books, and I was halfway through the second one. And I think it's, I guess, kind of a pattern where I get about halfway through a book and I think, like, I really need to be doing something else, because you reach this point where you're like, oh my God, I'm never going to finish this. This is killing me. I'm done with it. And I either need a distraction or to do something else. So I, for some reason, I guess I must have read one of the Welles books, like maybe Joe McBride's book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles. And I guess in the back of, just kind of through being somebody interested in film, I had heard stuff about The Other Side of the Wind over the years. And I had heard stories. And everything I'd ever read, maybe four or five places, there would be like two or three great stories, but no comprehensive telling of what really happened. So, you have all this great stuff like John Huston driving the wrong way on the highway, and you have, Rich Little showing up and John Huston thinking he's like an impressionist painter, and all this crazy crap. And, one of my favorite things was Welles getting incredibly frustrated at one point with the crew and screaming, who do I have to fuck to get off this picture? And, in the back, and when I read that, I remember thinking, he would have to fuck himself. I mean, that's the story. That, it's this self-created kind of thing that's either going to be brilliant or be a disaster. And he's tangled up in this web of his own, cinematic creation. So the first thing was I had read these stories. I don't know where I'd read all of them, but it seemed like, just fun. Now, secondly, I kind of started to think about the movie itself and what little I knew about it. And you have this guy who's Orson Welles to start with, who's the if not the greatest director, he's in the top three directors, or top five directors by most people's account. And, guy generally regarded as a genius, making kind of an end of career movie intended to be a real artistic statement, and possibly a real personal statement. And he's casting people from his own life playing people very much based on themselves. And in some ways, playing up their relationships with Wells opposite the main character, who's a director who's very much in the same situation that Wells is in. And I thought, oh my God, you know, the fact that this, he's making this movie at this time in his life is just struck me as extraordinary. And that there was just so much there as far as who he was, what the time in Hollywood was, and I guess really the idea of a guy making a movie, and not just a guy, I mean, you know, a great, epically important director, making a movie that starts out as art imitating life, that becomes kind of, you know, a little bit like his Apocalypse Now. You know, it's like where, you know, Coppola is all of a sudden presiding over, you know, is Colonel Kurtz presiding over, you know, his little kingdom in the Philippines while he's trying to make the movie, and kind of delving into his own, you know, falling into his own madness. Here's Wells making this movie that starts out as art imitating life, and at some point becomes life imitating art. And I guess it was, you know, really the thing that finally did it for me was the idea of exploring this guy. Getting, you know, not necessarily in a negative sense, but becoming lost in his own creative creation. You know, and there were many, many people I interviewed who, you know, repeated the same thing, which was, you know, the set was surreal at certain points because it was hard to tell what was the movie and what was really happening. So that's what got me interested. As far as, you know, how I started, I think one thing I learned was I tried to start kind of small in the sense that I made lists of every single person I could find who had anything to do with the film. And I started interviewing the less significant people, you know, people who were, you know, extras, people who had small parts, people who were crew members who were there for lesser amounts of time. Basically, I think so that I could kind of build up the momentum that by the time I needed to talk to people who were significant, I had either, you know, I'd interviewed enough people who were there and read enough stuff. I mean, I accumulated all the articles I could, you know, you could ever imagine, you know, every mention of it ever in Variety or Los Angeles Times or New York Times or Sight and Sound or any of the, you know, Kaita Cinema, anything. So I had read everything there was to read about it, and I had interviewed, you know, initially 15 or 20 people who were kind of outer members of the production. So by the time I started wanting to really find people who were essential to the story, you know, I had a pretty big head of steam, and I knew what I was talking about.
Yeah, I thought, you know, the main dynamic of the story of The Other Side of the Wind is really, you know, sort of Orson Welles' sort of friendships and his sort of deep relationships with both Gary Graver and Peter Bogdanovich. And, you know, like you said, the story of The Other Side of the Wind, as much as Orson tries to deny that it wasn't really related to his sort of friendship, mentorship with Peter Bogdanovich, it seems pretty close, wouldn't you think, to sort of what their dynamic was in a sense? Or
yeah, well, I mean, I think there's, you know, there's the great irony of the fact that, you know, Bogdanovich initially is playing, you know, a critic slash journalist who's writing a book about the main character. You know, this mythical director, Jay Canford, who is, let's just, he's not 100% Orson Welles, but, you know, symbolically, he's got a lot of similarities. And he starts out in 1970 as this character writing a book about this guy, which is what Bogdanovich was doing at the time. And he's really writing basically the same kind of book, too, which is an as-told-to kind of interview official book. And then 3 to 4 years later, when Rich Little leaves the cast, and Wells needs somebody to play Hannaford's protege, so the director's protege, who is a young director who used to be a journalist and a critic, who's made three consecutive hit movies and is like the toast of Hollywood. He gets Bogdanovich to play the role, which is, you know, one of the, I mean, yeah, it is really kind of hard to get much more surreal than that. So Bogdanovich actually transitions over the course of the making of the film from who he was in 1970 to playing who he is in 1974. And yeah, I mean, I think those relationships are really central to it. I mean, I think, you know, Wells, I am not a Wells expert in the sense that, you know, I'm not a Wells scout. So my opinion is a little more amateur than somebody who really, you know, studies Wells and has studied Wells for 20 years. But, you know, it seems fairly clear that in both his life and his films, to me, that the idea of male relationships, usually that involve some form of betrayal, you know, and also father-son, mentor-protege type relationships, are really, really, you know, at the core of what most of his films are about, even the Shakespeare films. You know, even something like Chimes at Midnight, where, you know, where Falstaff is betrayed by Hal. So he, I mean, I think in a way, you know, Wells kind of knew this about himself. I mean, he would never say it, but I mean, you know, he was living like a Shakespearean life. He was living this life that was of that scale, and he had these relationships that were like that. So he had Bogdanovich, who was, you know, it's like the classic story of the protege who worships the mentor, who then, at least for a time in Bogdanovich's case, surpasses the mentor in terms of commercial success. And, you know, that is all playing out in the background here. And then you have Gary Graver, where the relationship is a lot simpler because there's no rivalry. But Wells has a guy who is, you know, who completely dedicates his entire life. You know, I mean, his entire, the last 30-plus years of his life, not only to Wells, but to this movie. And I've always thought it would be fascinating if Graver was alive to ask him, you know, was it worth it to you, especially given that the movie's never been finished? And my suspicion, despite having never known him, is that he would probably say, yeah, it was. Because I think if you're somebody who cared about film that much, and if you're somebody who understood how important Orson Welles was to somebody who cared about film that much, I think it was worth it just to be there. I think that's the general consensus I get from most people, is even if they didn't get paid, even if the movie never got finished, even if it's been kind of, you know, a nightmare if they've been the person who's been trying to get the film finished, you know, it was all worth it because you got to be around, you know, extraordinary figure doing something extraordinary.
Yeah, but what's sort of, you know, tragic and ironic, I guess, in a sense, is that, you know, through reading your book, you know, both Graver and Peter Bogdanovich were always trying their best to help Orson Welles and help with the film and, you know, just help in any sense of trying to, you know, get him to be the best he could be or, you know, find opportunities for him. Yet for some reason, Orson Welles seemed to be very either paranoid or kind of worried that people had ulterior motives. And, you know, you see that sort of kind of play out through the course of the final years of Orson's life, where he's constantly questioning, you know, is this person really doing this for the sake of him? But it seems like everybody had the most positive motives at hand. But Orson seemed to just continue to question them for some reason. I don't know why, but...
I think a couple things happen. I mean, one, you know, you can really take the kind of psychological route and say, you know, what's the big childhood root of all of this? And, yeah, I think he grew up it, you know, as somebody who was an adult from a very young age. You know, he never really got to be a kid. He was a genius. You know, there's the legendary story of his mother telling him he's a genius while he's in his crib, whether that's true or not. He was kind of raised to be exactly what he became. And so the adult men in his life, his father, the guy who was his guardian, and the guy who was headmaster of his boarding school, all three of whom, I think, you know, cared a great deal for Wells, you know, obviously, and wanted what was best for him. Also, you know, were attached to him because he was this larger-than-life figure. And that was all okay, I think, for Wells in terms of male relationships until, you know, everything kind of went right for a long time. And then after Kane and after the kind of blow up with John Houseman, who I think probably as somebody who helped Wells achieve his vision and understood how to help Wells achieve his vision, and providing him exactly the kind of support he needed. After that, the male relationships become really fraught with a lot of stuff. And as those things get more and more fraught, the more and more I think he becomes, you know, not in the purest sense, but paranoid. He becomes untrusting. I think, you know, if you look back and you think about his childhood, you think, well, you know, I mean, these guys all loved him, but they also were all, you know, kind of like, hey, that guy, you know, they were latched on to a guy who was a rising star, who was clearly destined to be an important human being. I think there was this way in which he got no childhood as a kid, and then he became somewhat less adult as he dealt with people as he got older, and which is not to say he wasn't mature and you know, civilized, brilliant. But I think, you know, he started to have kind of, you know, less mature attitudes about trusting people. And he also had a terrible, terrible, terrible taste in business partners. And this is not speaking of Graver and Bogdanovich, but it's speaking of just in general, you know, he every movie he made, you know, during about a 5-year period, his partners were people, you know, turned out to be someone who would disappoint him time and time again and in every possible way. And I think Wells at one point said, you know, he realized that he was like somebody who every time they walk outside the house, they get struck by lightning. And at a certain point, you know, you start thinking, maybe it's not the lightning. So he, I think, had a really hard time trusting people. And, you know, I think he trusted Gary implicitly always because Gary was always working for Orson and always giving everything up for Orson. And I think Peter, who I think is very dedicated to Orson and always was, but because he became kind of an equal or, you know, a peer, that relationship became a lot more difficult, and Orson started trusting Peter less. And, you know, Peter had his own stuff going on. He had his own complicated life, and he had his own, you know, hang up. But I think, you know, when push came to shove, Peter always ultimately, even if it took time, forgave Orson and wanted to be of help to him.
Yeah, and you can see that, you know, as you were writing in the book, you know, Orson stayed in Peter's house for many years. You know, when Orson really needed money, he tried to get him an acting role in Nickelodeon. He, you know, tried to get Orson to adapt St. Jack and get the ball rolling. But for some reason, there was something in Orson where he would sort of try to almost like self-destruct a positive situation that would be laid out for him and almost turn it into a negative for some reason.
Yeah, you know, I think there's this way in which, and knowing, I mean, from what I, you know, what I know of him, it's kind of understandable, I think, in the sense that businessman. His, you know, his difficulties with, you know, keeping things organized in a professional sense, a creative sense, in a professional sense. All these things that were huge problems for him, and all this difficulty getting money, and all these things, that would never happen to somebody like Orson Welles today, no matter how difficult he was, because he would have the talent, and there would be people who would make it work for him. And instead, you know, here he was, and he was kind of trapped in this world where he, I think, unrealistically but rightfully wanted to be treated like someone who was as gifted as he was. And for him, that meant, you know, give me what I need and let me do what I do. And there's, you know, you don't negotiate with me. Don't give me a you know, don't make me sign a contract. Don't make me jump through any hoops. I'm, you know, and this isn't even in an arrogant way. I think he was kind of like, I am Orson Welles. You know, don't, you know, inside, I think, you know, he's like, why am I being dragged through this? Why am I being forced to, you know, to scavenge for funds? I mean, and the way in which he was making that movie, I mean, you know, you think about how inconceivable it is. I mean, he was literally living and making the movie paycheck to paycheck. And taking funds from, you know, one thing and putting them in another, and you know, utter chaos as far as the production and financing end of things. So I think, you know, with Bogdanovich, I think, you know, they had a complicated relationship to begin with. Bogdanovich had all this success, which Welles probably was a little jealous of, and then had all this difficulty, which I don't think Welles is super sensitive to. So I, you know, my feeling about, you know, going into this, about who Bogdanovich was, my feeling about who he was coming out of this really changed. I mean, I really came to see him as somebody, you know, a flawed human being just like Welles, but somebody who really, really, really went on the mat time and again, you know, was really dedicated to Welles as a person and as an artist.
Yeah, and you see that too in you know, the moment that you portray in the book when you know, they're at Carefree Arizona in the house and they're having lunch, and you know, Orson suddenly says, you know, if I don't make it through this, please promise me that you'll finish this movie. And you know, this was in the early 70s, and right. Now we go to the present day, and you know, Peter, I think, is still, you know, actively trying to finish the movie, and especially within in the news that's come out now that I guess the film may actually finally be complete.
Yeah. Yeah, Peter, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, I one of the things, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, yeah, and that's I've never been one of those people who's, you know, thinking about what anybody's thinking about in the afterlife, but I think if I were to believe all that, and if I were to think about that, I think somewhere Welles is probably really enjoying the fact that all these people are still working for him 30 years after his death. And, you know, fully engaged. You know, I mean, he's, you know, he's got Frank Marshall and Peter Bogdanovich. You know, I mean, two, you know, substantial, you know, guys, not to mention Philip, you know, Reemshaw and Jens Kuttner Call and other people, you know, who they're still trying to get his movie done. You know, and it still matters, and people are still working for him. There's a quote, you know, from Gary Graver shortly before he died, where he was talking to Joe McBride, and he said, I'm still working for, you know, I guess it was half joking, but he said, you know, I'm still working for Orson. I never stopped. And I think that, you know, there's always that thing. And it came up in a couple of interviews about what the making of this movie was all about. And, you know, a couple people said to me, not that, I don't think there was any doubt he wanted to finish the film, and there wasn't any doubt the movie was important to him. But I think what was interesting is there's also a side of it that Welles just liked getting up and making a movie every day. he liked being in control of a set. You know, he liked having all these people, you know, there to enact his vision. And I think, you know, that's also, you know, part of it. And I think, you know, it's fascinating that, you know, these, you know, folks are still there trying to enact his vision, you know, 40 years after, you know, nearly 40 years after they took the final shots and you know, 30 years after he died, and that there are people literally who have died trying to get this movie made. I mean, I think Gary thought this was the movie all along, thought, you know, this is the movie that's going to make, you know, change my life. And, you know, that just became, he had no choice but to do it. You know, I mean, this it became his life. It wasn't even going to change his life anymore. It was his life.
Yeah. You know what's, fascinating reading about the both the production process and also the financing process in your book. You know, it's documented in the book how, you know, Orson, the most of the money came from the brother-in-law of the Shah of Iran. And then he was, you know, shooting the movie in a house in Arizona. He was sort of stealing locations in Los Angeles. The production process was sort of all over the place. I'm curious if you could sort of describe, you know, your take on that sort of crazy production process that went on for years and years and years and years. The shooting of this film, you know, probably, what was it, 6 or 7 years that most of the shooting?
I would say it was kind of, on and off for, you know, 5.5 to 6 years.
Yeah.
And, one thing I'd say pretty early on that I realized was, even if you took away his, you know, lifestyle, even if you took away his, you know, not being in great health, and the fact that he smoked, an entire box of Cuban cigars every day, and he drank, you know, like 30 cups of coffee, and, a 12-pack of Fresca, and all this stuff every day. If you took away all of that, I could not have remained alive in his life for 1 week. I would have just had a heart attack and died. The level of, I think it was very, what would kill me was very stimulating for him. I don't want to overstate it, but I mean, you know, he was kind of making this movie on the run. And he was, you know, oftentimes making this movie where he didn't know where the money was going to come from. And then he was making, you know, deals with, I mean, the Shah's brother-in-law is funny because it sounds so ominous at first. This gentleman, Mehdi Bouchari, who was married to the Shah's sister, that he funded the movie, and you think, oh my God, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's, you know, what an insane person to have as your business partner. And, you know, in a lot of ways, Bouchari was, first of all, was a real good guy, was very cultured, very civilized, very calm, gentle, intelligent person. He's been portrayed as being this horrible guy who kind of kept everything from happening. From what I learned, he really, I mean, to his dying day, I mean, I think he died in 2006 at the age of 91. He still wouldn't, you know, he would only sign over the rights to his share of the film to somebody who was going to sign something saying that they would make it, they would complete it according to, you know, Orson's design and Orson's wishes and his notes. So, you know, it's kind of funny because, you know, it's insane that he had to go to the length of getting the Shah's brother-in-law to finance it. But it's also, you know, interesting because, you know, Bouchari's been portrayed as being this horrible guy. And he was really a good guy, and he really cared about, well, you know, one thing Wells did really well was people really cared about what he wanted and what his vision was. And, you know, he was a, you know, combination of brilliance and charisma and all these things that kept people with him. So the money thing, it's still crazy that it's the Shah of Iran's brother-in-law. That's crazy that nobody else is giving him money, really. He also goes through the experience of having one of the producers, another producer allegedly, you know, stealing some of the production funds. He loses cast members during the making of the film. He has, you know, people die during the making of the film, you know, because it takes a lot. He has Rich Little, you know, have to leave the set, even though he's playing a major role, and has to recap the major role 4 years into the production. He shoots, I know this, you know, this is, I'm kind of going out of sequence, but he shoots the film for the first 3 years without a lead actor. He doesn't cast John Huston in the lead until he's been making the film for 3 years. So what he does, which, not being a filmmaker, you know, kind of blew me away at first, was he just shot around him. He shot the other half of the scenes and figured he'd shoot, you know, the half with Huston or whoever played that role when he had it. So Wells literally would shoot something, say, in 1970 in Los Angeles, and he'd shoot people talking to the main character or reacting to the main character, and then or a different character, and then he might shoot the rest of that scene 4 years later in a totally different location. In some cases, he shot in a different location on a different continent, and with people who were never in the same room with the people who were acting the other half of the scene. And he, you know, as a filmmaker, I never really, you know, understood this, but I mean, you know, he was one of those filmmakers who carried the whole film in his head. So the continuity was Orson knew what he needed to do 4 years later when he got to Spain. He says, okay, the lighting was kind of like this back in Beverly Hills 4 years ago. And we'll just have a guy, you know, pass across the camera wearing a suit, you know, the same suit as one of the characters wore before. I mean, it was really fascinating to me that somebody could adapt to that kind of chaos. So it was, I mean, it was an incredibly chaotic shoot. And there were times where I think things seemed very much under control, and were very clear how brilliant Wells was, and it was very clear how inventive he was, and very clear how much he knew what was going on. And then, like in any movie, you know, there were times where he was kind of stuck. But the difference was, he was making this film under these crazy circumstances where, you know, he has money being stolen, he doesn't have money, he has people, you know, who play lead roles disappearing after they've shot their part. So I suspect there may, you know, somebody may know of a more crazy, chaotic film shoot, but I have not heard of one to this point.
What's also very interesting is how experimental and improvisatory he was in terms of, you know, there was a script, but really he was trying to take from the actors something that was very personal to them and try to bring that out. Like, for example, you know, the scene you describe in the book with Paul Mazursky and Henry Jaglom, where he knew that the two of them had a personal conflict, and he sort of surprised one of them and sort of pitted them against one another in this scene and sort of brought out their real conflict and somehow fictionalized it in a scene that he was shooting, which was, you know, really fascinating to read about.
Yeah, you know, I think, it, you know, creatively the movie was so ambitious in the sense of he was trying to do all these new things. You know, he'd written this massive script over the course of 25 years or 20 years, and he rewrote it, you know, on an almost nightly basis, and then he let people improvise based off of what he was writing and rewriting. And, you know, and visually and in the way it was structured, you know, he had all these different kind of creative conceits that were really, you know, huge changes from how he did things and how other people did things. But what was really, to me, the most amazing thing about the movie was the way in which he got people to perform. So your example is a perfect example, is, you know, Jaglom and Mazursky having this great fight that he kind of, you know, slow, you know, he knows there's tension between the two of them, and he brings them together as a surprise to Mazursky, who's never met him. And then he pits them against each other and then gives them the topic of this mythical filmmaker to start talking about. And their real tension spills into that. The thing that I always, you know, that I came away from even more so was, you know, he with you know, really ultimately the two leads in the film are Bogdanovich and Houston, and you have two guys with very, very well developed, larger than life public persona. You know, John Houston is John Houston. He is the most invulnerable human being who has ever walked the face of the earth. You know, nothing can kill him. You know, he can drink and smoke all he wants. He's just, he's like, you know, he's kind of like, you know, movie director Superman. And he's, you know, and he's got this great sense of humor and takes everything in stride and all that. And then you've got, you know, Bogdanovich, who is, you know, kind of your, on the surface, your classic image of, you know, a young, successful flick director in New Hollywood. And they absolutely, and he wanted them to play those parts as those parts, you know, as those persona, which is what people do. You hire somebody who's like what you think the character is. But what really was striking to me was there are just a couple of little moments, and I'm sure this was done with incredible directorial skill, because I don't think you tell people to do this. He got each of them to kind of give up the persona and show who the real person underneath it all is. So with Houston, you know, people said, you know, Houston was this, he was that, he was amazing, he was funny, he was charming, but somewhere deep down you had the sense he was like the loneliest man on the face of the earth. And you just get like three or four little moments of him where you see that. And with Bogdanovich, you also get, you know, this guy who's the opposite of that image. You get this, you know, really kind of sweet, innocent, also vulnerable guy. And when they interact in those moments, they make everything else in the movie work. I mean, I thought that was extraordinary, that he got these, you know, two guys who were directors. I mean, you know, they both acted, but really are directors, to give just unbelievable performances in which they reveal themselves without even knowing they're revealing themselves, I think, in the moment.
Yeah. I'm curious, in your research, you know, how much of the movie have you seen? And also, in terms of screenplays and editorial notes that Orson may have left behind, what have you had access to?
I've had access to enough screenplays to last me the rest of my life as far as reading screenplays. I mean, there's an archive at University of Michigan that had a huge number, you know, a lot of the correspondence from this period of his life and related to this project, which was really helpful, and has a lot of, you know, the scripts and the script rewrites and the rewrites and the rewrites and the rewrites. So I read a lot of the script over and over and over again. And, you know, and it's in different versions and different guises, and things change and things stay the same. And, you know, it's kind of, there's a lot of material there. As far as seeing the film, I've seen what is, I think, what most people who have seen the film in its current form and scene, which is basically there's a 45 to 50 minute version, obviously incomplete, that is partially edited by Wells, partially edited by Gary Graver, and that also includes, you know, maybe another 40 minutes. I mean, I may be up on the time, but, you know, maybe another 40 minutes of just scenes and footage. So there's like 40 or 50 minutes of edited storyline. And then there's, you know, kind of just extra scenes that haven't been put in the movie yet. And so I've seen that. I think that was the what Graver was using when he was trying to pitch the film to people over the years after Orson died. I think that was what he would show people as a way of trying to get somebody to fund the movie.
Yeah, and also, too, I guess to clarify, that's from the work print. That's not actually from the negative, which has been locked away in Paris for, you know, decades and decades.
Correct. It's, yeah, I've seen exactly what the work print.
So you know, this, you know, big story came out, I believe it was last October, the New York Times, about the possibility of the film finally being completed. What sort of, do you know if like this is sort of, you know, the pinnacle of that progress? Because, you know, as you chronicle in the book, there's been so many sort of false starts as, you know, far as, you know, people trying to finish the film. Do you think that we finally reached kind of the, you know, the end point and that the film will be completed now?
I think it's first of all, it's a great question. I think this is as close as it's ever gotten. And I think the right people are involved trying to get it done and have the right motives for trying to get it done. I mean, I think it's interesting because, you know, the people who stayed on the set with Wells and the people who stuck with him, the common thing that they all had is they were all there for the right reason, you know, within the concept of making that film, which was they were there because they believed it was important to help Orson Welles get a movie made because he was Orson Welles and that was important and he was making a movie and that was important and he was making a movie that he thought was important. So coming to it, you know, in kind of a way where you're not expecting anything other than to help this happen, I think is the only way things can work out. And you have, you know, a bunch of guys with Peter Bogdanovich and Philip Rimsha and Jens and Frank Marshall who are really, I mean, what they want to do is make it happen. And they've got, I think as a result of their kind of being fairly egoless about this, they've gotten close. On the other hand, you know, I don't know all the details of what's going on right now. I don't know, it seems like they've continued to make progress and it seems like they keep getting closer. I don't think it's happened as fast as anybody, including them, would like for it to happen. And every time it doesn't just happen, which is an unrealistic expectation anyway, given its history, you get all the people who were involved with the making of the film, you know, saying, well, you know, I will finally believe it when I'm sitting down in a theater and I have seen the end credit roll. So I think they're close. I think they're doing a great job with it. I think they've sacrificed a lot to get there, and I'm very hopeful that they will complete it, and I think they're very hopeful that they'll complete it, but it's not a simple process. So it's not, you're not going to sit down and watch it.
Yeah. I mean, from what, you wrote about in the book, you know, so many people have their hands sort of legally in the other side of the wind, whether it be, Beatrice Wells or, Oya Kador, or, you know, sort of the actual principal financiers of the movie, of one of which, you know, passed away, as you said. So probably the legal entanglement of the film is probably, would you say that's what has prevented it from being finished after all these years? The sort of complicated, tangled web.
Yeah, the web is more tangled than, you know, it's about as tangled of a web you can find because, you know, some of it is the ownership. Some of it is just the way Wells left the deal. You know, the structure of the deal he made to finance the film. The way in which he left his estate really complicated things. The fact that the negative wound up in Paris, where the laws are different and confer different rights upon different people, meaning, you know, that in France, and I, you know, don't want to misstate what the international, you know, legal implications are, but, you know, in France, there's a thing called the droit d'auteur, which is the right of the author, which is basically that a moral right to any work of art always reverts to the art. And Beatrice Wells, being Orson's heir, has inherited that. So she had kind of the moral right to this, you know, to some creative aspect of the film, which, you know, in the United States doesn't necessarily mean a lot to even think about. You don't think about moral right to a work of art. And then you have Oya Kodar, who was left, you know, Wells' unfinished film, of which this is one. And, you know, she was Orson's mistress, and Orson was still married, you know, through the end of his life to Beatrice's mother, Paula Mori. So there's, you know, some, you know, I've spoken to Beatrice, and I don't think she has any resentment towards Oya because of that relationship, but I think it certainly doesn't help matters when it's, you know, somebody's mistress and the daughter of the person who they were married to. So you've got that. You've got, you know, the whole fact that this was, you know, owned by an Iranian company that was headquartered in Paris, and that, you know, people involved with that have died. There have been deals over the years that have just fallen apart because of money. I mean, I think there's that possible solution always of, you know, if we just pay everybody enough, this will all be over with and we can get on with things. And my sense was that every time you could get, you know, say there were, for simplicity, say there are three parties that really have to come together. If you got two of them together, the third one always walked up on the deal. And it changed every time. Somebody always walked away. So sometimes it was money, sometimes it was personal animosity, sometimes they'd get on the threshold of a deal and there was some form of jealousy. Sometimes deals were being made, the same deal was being made with more than one person at the same time. which, you know, doesn't lead to a lot of successful deal making. So, you know, it's the whole gamut. I mean, anything that could get in the way of a film getting released after the director's death has happened. So it's not a simple, you know, who owns what. It's everything and anything that could screw up the completion of a film has screwed up the completion of this film.
Yeah, and, you know, as you wrote about in the book, you know, there's been sort of a close deal that was made with Showtime that sort of lasted, you know, probably about 10 years that kept, you know, starting and stopping, and that seemed to be sort of one of the closest deals that was going to come through, I believe.
Yeah, and you know, and that, you know, that fell apart for, you know, different reasons. Different parties had different reactions, you know, to that deal. I mean, I think, you know, some people were opposed to it because they were, you know, not thrilled with what they thought Showtime would do with it, and they thought it belonged on a big screen. Some people were opposed to it because they want more money. Some people agreed to, you know, make a deal with Showtime and then use their offer as leverage with somebody else. You know, it's really, you know, again, any, you know, I interviewed Matthew Duda, who was the executive at Showtime, and he hadn't been involved with it, but he had an interest in the film from the day he started working at Showtime until the day he retired, and never saw the film get finished. You know, and he's a very competent, very intelligent, you know, very successful guy in the TV world, and he was probably at it for about 15 years, and he could never get it done, just because, you know, it's like that game was a Jenga or whatever, where you stack up all the pieces. Somebody always pulled the piece up right before things were gonna happen.
Yeah, what's a little trivia fact that you have in the book is that you know, CBS, which owns sort of the Showtime wing, Les Moonves was actually an extra in The Other Side of the Wind at a certain point.
Right. I mean, that was, you know, when you were asking me about, you know, how I began researching it, one of the really, after I did the kind of book, you know, and you know, and magazine and newspaper research and started interviewing people, it was a lot easier to find people who had been in the movie or involved with the movie than I could ever have imagined, because anybody who was there for 2 minutes keeps it on their resume. So And no matter whether they're a star, you know, whether they're famous or whether they're somebody who never worked in film again, somewhere on the internet you can find that, you know, somebody was, you know, people were involved. So I was able to find tons of people. And there's this great story that when Showtime was you know, deeply involved in it, you know, in this project, somebody came to La Moonva and, you know, said, I got to talk to you about this thing. We're doing it at Showtime. It's this unfinished Orson Welles movie called The Other Side of the Wind. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. And La Moonva said, heard of it? I'm in it. And, which is, I mean, that is the perfect, you know, perfect indication of what this movie was like. You know, people just all over the place, you know, were there for, Cameron Crowe was there. You know, he was an extra for a couple of days when he was, I think, you know, all of 19 years old. You know, all these people just kind of were involved. And the funny thing with Les Moonves, too, which was also very similar to other people who were involved, is I thought, you know, well, I don't know what he did, and I'm sure, you know, but, you know, I don't know what he's going to have to say, but it would be interesting to talk to him, and I'm sure it's a long shot. So I got in touch with, you know, CBS Publicity, and they were, you know, pleasant, but kind of, you know, I've done this enough that, you know, I got the sense that they were like, yeah, you know, Mr. Moonves will speak to you, no. You know, but we'll pass your request on to him. And I got an email back, you know, the next day, and they were like, oh, he'd love to talk to you. You know, and he just wanted, you know, he's a real nice guy, and he really just wanted to, he's like, wow, tell me about The Other Side of the Wind. Yeah, I was there. And I think that, in a lot of ways, is such a big piece of the story of the film, is, you know, just getting to be around Welles, both as a creative person and as a personality, I think was just an extraordinary experience for people. You know, I mean, you know, here's a guy who's accomplished so much in his life, and the one or two days he spent on the set in Arizona, you know, you think about all the famous people he's met and all the famous people he's dealt with, but yeah, he really, you know, he remembers that he was an extra on the movie, you know, that Orson Welles made for 2 days. I mean, I think it's just, I don't think necessarily there are people like that or who leave that kind of impression.
Yeah, just a, you know, larger than life figure, a, you know, mythic figure in a sense, and you know, I think that's what kind of attracted everybody to him.
And people, and somebody who earned that, you know,
yeah,
not somebody who's just, oh, they're, you know, they're famous, or oh, they're larger than life, or oh, they're incredibly talented. He was all of it, you know. He was the real deal. I mean, he was a guy who was genuinely larger than life and deserved every bit of it. He got, in fact, his daughter Beatrice said that, you know, she spent, you know, a great deal of time with her parents, and she said they were living in Europe, and she said it wasn't until she was about 21 or 22 years old that she realized that that everybody didn't get stared at when they went out to dinner. You know, she thought that everybody in the world, that everybody's father was stared at wherever they went, because her dad was Orson Welles. And she just thought that's the way the world worked, you know, because he was just her dad. But he was a guy, I mean, you know, wherever he went, you know, it wasn't like, oh, hey, there's that famous guy. It was like, whoa, 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 that is Orson Welles. You know, and that, you know, that I think is, you know, one of the things, you know, maybe not the most important thing about it, but I think he was really extraordinary in that way. He commanded attention without asking for it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, so your book, it's being released in April, is that correct?
Yeah, April 21st.
Okay, and people can find it on Amazon.com or...
Yeah, it's you'll be able to find it in bookstores come April 21st. You can pre-order on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any of the online booksellers right now, and it'll remain available, obviously, online. You know, but yeah, it will be released in the bookstores April 21st.